the ability to do whole table things. Technically, I just self-reference a table. So we're gonna, if I check, I've got a sequence number, the maximum sequence is equal to the count of rows, I know I've got no gaps in my numbering. It's sort of a weird constraint, but it shows the use of subquery expressions inside the checks. But both products don't have this. It's kind of interesting. I can, no department can be over 100 people. This sort of thing is technically possible. Not widely implemented. Sorry about that.
Exactly this example, what you have there, is a wonderful thing that comes up every so often, because the Postgres database has a pretty good problem with these aggregates, max, count, and so on. And people are used to databases that shortcut these aggregates in a way by looking up via an index, which is the maximum column or the maximum value.
Yeah, it's either an index or it's count. In the stat table.
Now, the interesting thing here is, especially the count aggregate, is a thing that gets fuzzy if you try to shortcut that on a technical level, because it is dependent on your concurrency model in the database. And therefore, those check constraints are likely to become performance killers if you have a database that is multi-version concurrency control.
Actually, for these, I'd probably put them in an insertion.
Yeah.
And that way there's one simple thing that has answered the question, so when somebody else comes in, the assertion knows, well, I'm still true, and I don't have to worry about it. If I've got a lot, I've got to look at the table level, I'm a little scared too. Performance is a problem, but also just, I'm not quite sure what happens when I have multiple users hitting the same table. If I got it at the schema level, I just feel more comfortable. There's no logical basis for that, really. It can all be handled with an implementation. But, okay, a little trick with constraints. I want to create a table of physical constants. And I've got a key column, character 1, it defaults to X. I check to see that it's always equal to X. Then I load in all of my constants as defaults. And then I do an insert physical constants default to bring this up. It can only have one row and it can't be changed. I have to drop it or delete everything from it. But if I play that script, I'm guaranteed that my table of constants is there for me to use. A lot of programmers who are used to having a declared constant statement in their language kind of like using that. Also, we decide to change the value of pi. Another one for the foreigners. At one point in this country, the state of Tennessee tried to change the value of pi to 3 because one of the state legislators thought that 22/7 was too hard for the kids, and at least it was for him. So he's going to pass a law. It's a good way to get your constants in, and just the insert into defaults will bring them all up. It's portable. It guarantees that everybody's got the same attribute. The usual arguments for having a declared constant statement apply here. Unique constraints are kind of fun. Technically, the primary key is a special case of the unique constraints. It gets a little extra bonus. I can have 0 or 1 primary key per table. This one always drove me nuts. We actually debated this one in the committee. But you can technically have a table without a primary key in SQL, but in relational land, to be a table, you gotta have a key, at least one of them. I don't know, maybe we should have come up with another name for it, like workspace or something that doesn't have a key. We did. Now, primary key with a list of columns is automatically not null in Unity. I strongly recommend that you declare the not nulls on the primary key. on each of, each of the columns for the primary, just in case somebody does an alter table and moves the primary key or changes it in some way. At least you've still got the not nulls there left over from the original declaration. You need to have one null in each of the columns that make it up the list. And both can be used by referencing, by reference clauses. In the case of
one null?
Yeah, you can have up to one null. The idea is that the unique, when I do a group by, I go by groups, all the nulls go into one group, right? That was also debated. Technically, if null doesn't equal null, all of the nulls should form their own group when I do a group by. Okay, we had a little debate about that, so we made up a thing about grouping being different from just regular old equality comparison. A little hand waving. Now, the real reason it was done for the group by was that we had a show of hands, how many of you put all the nulls in their own group? One product, can't remember who at the time. And then everybody, and how many of you put all your nulls into a single group? All of them. Okay, fine, let's vote. And that was how the decision was really made. Then we did a little cover up, a little clean up later, about grouping. The unique constraints come out of the grouping idea. So, again, it's unique, yeah, but you're allowed a null. Don't do it. You can avoid it at all. Don't do it. It messes up things. It's not necessarily portable. So we're getting better about it. The other thing with the unique, though, is you can have more than one unique constraint on the table, and they can overlap each other. So you can play some really nice games with that. How about a table called marriages? I've got a husband, I've got a wife, and the primary key is husbands and wives together. So I only have unique pairs. Okay, polygamy. Notice that husband appears once, wife appears once in a marriage. Polygamy, since I'm from Utah, terribly behind my neighbors. Only one wife. But the husband can appear multiple times. The wife appears only once. Now, I technically don't have to declare that primary key again. A lot of times, though, you will go ahead and declare overlapping keys to get the indexing in your product. So you have what's called a covering index. That is, the index contains enough information in itself that you don't have to go to the base table to answer your common queries. Okay, trade-off. I'm building another index. I've got to maintain it, updates, inserts, deletes. Might be worth it, might not be worth it. Polyandry, okay. Husband appears once, and multiple wives can... Oh, did I get that wrong? Polyandry, yeah, the other way. Jeez. I'm sorry, that's completely wrong. Then, of course, corporate marriages. Husbands and wives can appear all over the place. Nobody's unique. But try this one for overlapping constraints. I've got a class schedule. I've got a teacher, the class they're teaching, English 101, whatever, the room, and the time period. So if you, in the U.S., it's usually six periods to a school day. So obviously, you can have a super key. Make sure that none of that appears. Use all the columns. But what about the other rules I've got? Just think about it for a minute. Assuming that a teacher only does one class, obviously a teacher can't be in two classrooms during the same period, that sort of thing. Mrs. Jones is teaching English 101 in room 222, sixth period. So she obviously can't be doing anything else during that period.
I have to object again.
Okay.
SQL 3 defines in 420 and temperature constraints. A unique constraint is satisfied if and only if no two rows in a table have the same nominal value in the unique column. That means there are there can be multiple nodes.
In different columns?
No, in the same column.
Yeah, we have
just not the same non-null. So null does not equal null. Is satisfied in this. So you can't have multiple null that do not collide. Because null is not equal to null.
I'll have to get it out again. The 99 standard changed a few things. Maybe I ought to clear this up. I do SQL 92 because that's what's been implemented in most products. Actually, that's what most products are still trying to implement.
I'm
here
sure
in the year
that
2004.
92
contains
the same.
So they are. Get with me offline. I'll say for example, we had some debates about that. We got back to the unique predicate versus the unique constraint. And I honestly have to look it up. But in general, you like to have not null unique, because the nulls do get in the way, and you can get some confusing situations. But okay, yeah, give me offline. It's quite possible that 99 said it. I'm wrong. I would honestly have to pull out my 99 stuff, which is now in a cardboard box I'm getting ready to move, or I can't find it. But okay, teacher is in only one room in one period, sort of a physical constraint. You can't be in two places at once. I teach only one class each period, so I'm not doubling up in the same room teaching English and history at the same time. A room has only one class in it per period, no doubling up, no teaching history and English in the same space. And a teacher is in only one room at one time. Well, version one, which is wrong, I just sort of grab the rules and try and turn them into unique constraints. You know, all the column names that were mentioned. Yeah, it's a mindless way to do it. But again, you'll see a lot of people doing it this way. It's the first sort of impulse thing. I've got three columns, I'll just make that particular combination of three columns unique. And I'll assume that it follows the rules. Well, actually, it doesn't. I can insert myself teaching database in room 222 and 223 in sixth period, and I can also have a Ms. Shields doing database 101 in the same room that I'm teaching database 102. The naive approach doesn't work. Slightly corrected version. I need two unique constraints to get my rules. And it really takes a little time to sit down and figure some of these out. Anybody still use decision tables?
Yeah.
It's going to be really handy for complicated things. Yeah, it's like a spreadsheet for logic. You put down the conditions, you've then got columns of yes, no, don't care. And you can actually get packages to do it. There's a Logic Gem, and I think there's a couple of freebies available. But for really complicated predicates, they're really handy. You fill out the grid, you push the button, it'll tell you if anything's redundant, if any combinations are missing, if you've got any contradictions in your logic. Really handy tools. I don't know why they sort of fell out of favor. In the old days, of course, when you had to put the stuff in on punch cards, it was not be able to interact with it, to change things on the fly. It was a little rougher. But these days, the grid is no more trouble than filling out a spreadsheet. But okay. There's the three bullets there are the logic behind it. The teacher teaches in only one room each period. In a given period, and teacher should be able to determine the room from those two. I'm looking for combinations of keys. And if the teacher teaches only one class, each period, class is then dependent on the combination of the teacher and the period. That would be a location. And the same logic holds for the last two rules, the numbers 3 and 4. Again, it's a good little mental exercise for you. Okay. References clause, singular, multiple column syntax. If I do not give a column list in the referenced table, it assumes the primary key. And essentially, I'm matching values. You know, You can have this combination in this table, it references another table, and it exists over there. If I do a unique constraint, if I reference a unique constraint, I do have to give the column list. Cute one. You usually have to give it in the same order in both places. Now, why's that got some problems? In a lot of products that are based on indexes, when you create a primary key, say city and state, you'd like to order the primary key because of the way the indexes are built by the most discriminating thing first. So there's only 50 states, but there's thousands of cities. So I might want to do city-state in the primary key to get a good index. However, if I go over to the other table and I've got it in state-city order, it can mess up some products. Some are smart enough to get the order right, some aren't. In general, it's kind of nice if they are in the same order in both places. It's just a little easier for a human being to take care of, too. Referential actions, still a little new in a lot of products, but really handy. Basically, the two events, and that's what they're referred to as database events, that I want to watch for are delete and update. There are no actions on insert in the standard. You will see insert triggers in some products, so you can sort of write your own insert stuff. But on delete, I can restrict or no action. I can cascade the delete so that when I say I'm doing a typical order entry thing, I've got an inventory, and when I remove a product from inventory, I also cancel it in all the orders. I can do a complete recall. That's the cascade. It goes over, and I can have cascades, cascades, cascades. The whole database can go up like a bunch of firecrackers, a chain of firecrackers. Or I can set it to a null, assuming the column's nullable. Don't assume necessarily that your schema is going to check that at the schema creation time. It might actually wait till there's data. Remember, all constraints on an empty table are true. Or I can set it to the default. So I discontinued the product in inventory. My default value is a refund. And I send them something called refund. On update, same thing. If I change a value, you know, we replaced the steel screw with an aluminum screw, I can go ahead and change the part number all the way through the database. And the same basic actions on the update. If no action specified, we're assuming going to restrict. This says simply give a warning and prevent the action from happening. Just stop it. I'm sorry, you can't delete that from the orders because you can't delete that from inventory because we still have orders for it. We either have to go over one by one, cancel all the orders, and then you can take it out of inventory. Okay. Now, this ability, as each action goes through and triggers more and more actions, could be good if that's what you're meant to do. Because the database is enforcing your business rules. Or it can be really dangerous. Take a lot of time to execute. If I've got any circular references, I can wind up in a loop. Or just completely hung up. And if you didn't know exactly what you were doing, you can find out too late that you didn't know what you were doing. One of the examples of this is with an adjacency list model. If I have a circular reference in my adjacency list model, and I have a rule about if I fire somebody, I want to fire all their subordinates, and I try and set it up with referential actions. So much for personnel. I just deleted everybody. The Egyptian school of management. When the pharaoh dies, you bury his slaves with him. Not appreciated by a lot of corporations. But it's another one, circular references in these. And this used to be a real problem in the first version of DBT when they tried it. I've got a change in table A that goes over to change B and C. But there's something in B that also fires when there's a change made, and it goes to C. Okay, what if those actions from A and B hit the same row in C, and they're different?
Yes.
If they're the same, you probably get the same sort of action. But, okay, I'm now trying to change a value to two different things. Technically, well, first of all, I shouldn't be allowed to do this. And I should get some sort of horrible error and a nice rollback. The decision in the first releases of DB2 was the last guy that got there won. He overwrote whatever was there for a cascaded update. This led to some problems because you can do the same action again and again, and maybe the first process would get there last, depending on, you know, the size of the queries and other things, basically which way the wind was blowing that day. I can also do the same thing with the self-references on the adjacency list model, where things are circular. In general, you want to avoid circular cascades and referential integrity constraints. Little trick for that, draw some circles and arrows on a piece of paper and just look at it, see if there's any cycles of any kind, and try and keep it in the tree structure. It's going to take you a couple of minutes. You can use an ER diagram, print it out, get a highlighter, and mark the referential actions on it. See the things happen. The other thing is make sure that, for example, with my inventory example, that if something changes, I do have the cascades and deletes the same all the way over, so I don't wind up with an orphaned value sitting out somewhere in the schema that doesn't have anything to back to reference. Okay. Create domain came in as part of the 92. You'll also see it called user-defined data types with proprietary implementations. It's essentially a nice, easy shorthand. We weren't too ambitious in the standard about it. I don't know why more products don't implement it. I don't really think it would be that hard. Essentially, the way we've got to define the standard, it's a column definition macro. I give a name for the domain. I give the data types, the check constraints, and all that. And instead of putting in a built-in data type, I just put in the name of the domain instead. So I can have something called UPC or EAN. And in my create domain statement, I define it. I define a check constraint on the check digits. I put in my default value. Everything would be there. And every time I needed a product code, I'd type in UPC for the type. Now, there's also an alter domain statement in the standard. So right now, the U.S. is about to face a horrible problem. We lost to the Europeans. We're about to add an extra digit to the UPC code. Think about this one. All your candy bar wrappers are going to change. And it's going to be a cute thing for retail. Also, the G10 is coming. Global Trade Identification Number, which is 15 digits long. And it's going to replace the ISBN. There's a whole bunch of things, the standardized codes that's going on right now that, you know, unless you're in retail, you don't really see in the popular press. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about the change to EAN from UPC codes. So you might want to look it up. But it's something like the taunt on barcodes. The guy had to come up with a sexy headline. But with an alter domain statement, I go to one place in the schema, change the domain, and if it's properly implemented, that will cascade through the schema, and I'm set. So much for the need for surrogate keys and chains like that. If it properly implements SQL 92, it doesn't need surrogates. And we've already done the classes. Okay. It's going on 1206.